All right, this is Gary Parrish again from CBS Sports. It's now Monday, December 21st, and this is the Eye on College Basketball podcast. I'm joined by Matt Norlander and Sam Vecenie, and Norlander and I get to spend quality time together in Brooklyn on Saturday. We saw Bryce Johnson get benched for cussing and then ball out during North Carolina's win over UCLA. Then we watched Ohio State upset Kentucky, and we're going to get to that, plus Monmouth, plus Butler, plus some other things later on, but it seems appropriate to start with the big news of the day. Honestly, if you're wondering why we got to the podcast a little later today, it's because as we were getting ready to talk, breaking news, Denzel Valentine, I think this is fair to say, National Player of the Year favorite at this point, going to be sidelined for 2 to 3 weeks, minor knee surgery, apparently suffered an injury attempting a layup in Sunday night's practice, had surgery early on Monday, expected to be out 2 to 3 weeks. Sam Vecenie, I'll start with you. How big of a deal is this for the Michigan State Spartans, the top-ranked Spartans?
Well, it's an incredibly big deal. I think that's pretty clear. I mean, he takes something like 30% of their shots, is second in the country in assist rate. Like, he is their, I don't want to say their entire offense, but their offense certainly revolves around him like Earth revolves around the sun. It's not an exaggeration to say that. Like, they are incredibly dependent on him on that end of the floor. So it's going to be interesting to see like how this kind of goes, you know, like they're going to start Aaron Harris, it looks like, but Tom Izzo hasn't really been quiet, we'll say, about how his development has gone thus far this season, especially on the defensive end of the floor. I guess this means more ball for Tum Tum Nairn to try and create. It puts them in a position where they could lose to Oakland tomorrow, I would say. I mean, that's not out of the question. Kay Felder's really good. Oakland has a few other really nice pieces, and that's at a neutral floor. I believe it's at the Palace in Auburn Hills.
Correct.
So that's kind of going to be a fun game now.
Oh, I actually, even without knowing that Denzel was going to be sidelined, thought it was going to be a fun game no matter what. Now it's a winnable game for Oakland. I'm not predicting an Oakland win, but it wouldn't be crazy to think Oakland could get this done on a neutral court, because they do have the type of dynamic player who can put, who can carry a team to a big time win in a 40-minute basketball game. And that's the kid you mentioned, Kay Felder. By the way, I talked to Kay this morning and his coach, Greg Campy, at Oakland, and I'll be writing a column about them heading into tomorrow night's game against Michigan State. I don't want to put words in your mouth, Sam, but did you nickname just now Denzel Valentine the Sun?
I did not nickname him.
I think I used
a metaphor or a simile to discuss his importance.
Denzel Valentine, a.k.a. the Sun. Yeah. Does this end? Can you miss 3 weeks and still be a National Player of the Year, Norlander? Is there any precedent for that?
Good question. You can, in my opinion. We'll see what Michigan State does without him and when he comes back. But in theory, yes, Michigan State, they start with two roadies in Big Ten play. They'll play Iowa December 29th, and they're at Minnesota. Both of those are winnable. Iowa's obviously a much more difficult game. I think he can, but the thing is, now Providence missed a couple games with Chris Dunn, who just had a virus, and it depends on what Dunn is able to do. Buddy Hield, my preseason pick for the National Player of the Year, what he is able to do with Oklahoma, who's been really strong. But absolutely, Valentine, with what he's done, if he can get back by, say, the return game on Iowa, Thursday, January 14th, if he's able to return by then, or the road game against Wisconsin on the 17th, get back in time for that, still return to the same level of production and keep Michigan State in the conversation for a number one seed. I think he will still be in the discussion for National Player of the Year, but this is going to be really intriguing because, to me, Valentine, Michigan State has some nice pieces, but Valentine means so, so, so much and has done so much for that team. We could have a super intriguing situation if they take a dip, if they lose three games without him, and then he returns and they're really, really good again to the point where they're right there with Maryland being the best in the league. Well, then how will we evaluate them down the road when it comes to seeding and it comes to his National Player of the Year credentials?
A couple of interesting things with the calendar. There's never a good time to have minor knee surgery, but if you were ever going to have minor knee surgery as a college basketball player at Michigan State, now's probably the time to do it. If it is genuinely 3 weeks from today, that is, I mean, and that seems to be the long end of it. You know, like it's 2 to 3 weeks, so let's call it three. Well, that's January 11th. That means that he misses Oakland, Iowa, Minnesota, Illinois, and Penn State. But if he's able to come back 2.5 weeks, he only misses 3 games. Like, you know, so
in the league, yeah.
Yeah, so if you only miss 3 games out of a 35-game situation or whatever it is, yeah, he'll be right there for this. Won't be the end of his National Player of the Year candidacy if he is back when expected and plays at the level I was going to say been playing at. He hasn't been great recently, but certainly at the level he's played at through in totality the first 12 games of the season. Beyond that, there's this. Michigan State, and I had paid attention to this earlier in the month just to sort of try to get a grasp on when are they really going to be at risk again to lose a game. Because like how long will they stay number one in the country? Because I don't know that many people think they're actually the best team in the country, but you look at their resume and you go, well, they should be number one. You know, they got to win over Louisville. They got to win over Providence. They got to win over Kansas. If you ask people hey, who's the best team in the country? I don't know that you'd get many Michigan States, but who's got the best resume in the country? You get a lot of Michigan States. So here we are. My point is this, they don't play another currently ranked team until January 23rd. That's Maryland at home. They don't play another currently ranked team on the road until they get Purdue on February 9th. And so, you know, listen, you can lose to unranked teams. We saw Kentucky, Carolina, and Iowa State do it on Saturday. But my point is they don't have this brutal schedule upcoming that they're going to have to tackle without Denzel. He'll be back by the time most of their important, you know, big challenges are on the schedule.
Yeah, I would note a couple things based off of what you said. In Providence, I mean, Chris Dunn has missed the last 2 games. So yes. If Denzel Valentine comes back after 3 games, after 4 games, it certainly doesn't preclude him from being the National Player of the Year, in my opinion. Second, I would look toward December 29th right now as the big test as far as whether or not Michigan State will stay undefeated and stay number one for an extended period of time. They go to Iowa. We've seen Iowa be pretty good thus far. I mean, they have wins over Marquette, Wichita State, Florida State.
That's a very losable game.
Yeah.
With Denzel Valentine, you could lose that game.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, they took Iowa State to the limit in Hilton. Probably should have beaten Iowa State in Hilton until a bit of a collapse. But, yeah, I think that, you know, Michigan State's probably going to end their unbeaten run during this stretch at some point without Denzel Valentine. The question is, does it happen Tuesday? Does it happen next Tuesday? You know, that's fine. Like you guys said, they're probably not the best team in the country. They certainly don't have the highest upside in the country, at least as far as their potential to win a national title. But thus far, they've been the best. They have something ridiculous like 6 top 100 wins, I want to say. And a lot of those have been pretty solid wins, like the ones over Providence and Louisville. So, and Kansas, obviously, that totally slipped my mind early in the year. So yeah, they're going to be fine. They're still going to be a 1-2 seed in the NCAA tournament, in my opinion. It's just getting Denzel back and getting rolling again and hoping that you didn't peak too early in the year.
If I were guessing, and that's all I'm doing, I would guess that they will start the season now 13-1 with a loss at Iowa. I bet you they'll be an underdog at Iowa now.
Yeah, they should.
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
I think they'll probably be an underdog at Iowa. Well, let's back up a little bit to the weekend. Saturday, Norlin and I were both in Brooklyn at Barclays Center for the CBS Sports Classic. It was North Carolina UCLA. UCLA like had a double digit lead in the first half. Then Bryce Johnson got unbenched and put up a career high 27 points. He was really, really good. I think he finished 11 of 12 from the field. Whatever. The more interesting development from that day was the one you were courtside for, Matt Norlander, and that is Ohio State's upset of Kentucky. Now, just so everybody understands, this is not your typical Thad Matta Ohio State team. They entered 5-5. Ohio State did. First time in his career that Thad Matta's had a 5-5 team. And so, you know, they had lost at home to UT Arlington, lost at home to La Tech, lost a neutral to Memphis. Again, this is not a good Ohio State team. And yet they jumped to a big lead on Kentucky, end up winning comfortably, even though it got to be a one-possession game around the four-minute mark. They pulled away late. And so now Kentucky's sitting here, and they've got a win over Duke. But I don't even know what the win over Duke means because, like, Duke isn't great, and Duke doesn't have anything on its resume positive outside of maybe a a win over Indiana, and Indiana's clearly not great. So, like, I think from the weekend, you can have really big questions about two of the teams that played in last year's Final Four. That's a young Duke team and a young Kentucky team, because though they still have, I'll use Sam's term from earlier, tremendous upside, a high ceiling, they haven't, you know, it's December 21st, and they really haven't done much positive to date. What did you make of Kentucky's performance against Ohio State in Orlando?
I actually felt like in the aftermath of it, collectively, there wasn't as much shock as there should have been. I mean, two ways to look at it. One, this kind of loss happens almost every single season with Calipari, and I say that in regard to going into the game, Ohio State was 73rd in KenPom. The win actually jumped him up to 55, but with the exception of last season and the Anthony Davis team, Calipari has had at least one, and in most years at Kentucky, he's actually had two, three, sometimes even four losses to sub-70 KenPom teams. So UK usually takes on a bad loss, so it's not necessarily that shocking, I guess, in that regard. But if you'd seen Ohio State play and they got absolutely romped by UConn, and you look at their personnel and you look at what Kentucky had going in, I mean, nobody had Ohio State even being competitive in the game. I was hoping that they could keep it within single digits so I would have something of an interesting story to write afterward. And then they go out and they win. And granted, they shot really well. Calipari said afterward, he said, every team gets beer muscles against us, and meaning that basically when they play us, they go for broke. You know, they don't play scared. They just, they'll take shots. They'll play in certain ways that when Cal watches the tape or his assistants watch the tape, they don't see those tendencies show up whatsoever. And there's probably something to that, because when you play Kentucky and you play Duke, I think more than any other teams, I think players get up for those games simply because of the programs, coaches, and talent involved. I think there's something definitely to that. With your, in regard to your thoughts on Kentucky and Duke's resume so far, there is something to that. As we're recording this podcast, the AP poll has not been released yet. It'll be pretty interesting to see where those teams fall. There is a case to be made that neither should be in the top 15, because Kentucky's best win is over Duke. Indiana's not – listen, they got that Indiana win Duke did on its home floor, and Duke has not lost a non-conference home game in a generation. So it's insane what they've been able to do, and they did win comfortably over IU. But outside of that, VCU and Georgetown are nice wins, but Georgetown is looking worse by the week, to be honest with you. Doesn't help my mom in this case. I'm very aware of that. And then VCU, they're not as strong, I think, as we thought they would be. So both good teams with a lot of potential, but you cannot say with any sort of conviction or any sort of evidence that Kentucky and Duke are top 10 teams right now.
No, there's not much on the resume. Just some more breaking news as we're talking in real time. Tom Izzo has officially been nominated for the Naismith Hall of Fame. He's a first-time nominee. I would expect he gets in, right? I mean, how do you keep Tom Izzo out of the Hall of Fame?
He's got more Final Fours in the past 20 years than any coach in college basketball. I would think he will get in.
He's the only...
Like, right away, not wait. He'll be in.
Do you think that they make him...
That will happen this season in April. Tom Izzo will be inducted to the Hall of Fame.
I think so. Other nominees, these guys have been nominated before. Bo Ryan, Eddie Sutton, Gene Cady, Rolly Massimino, and Lefty Driesell. But obviously...
Man, that's crazy class.
Yeah, but obviously Izzo is the one...
Well,
I was going to say, do you think that they make him wait a year so that they can get Bo in? Or do you think that they go both? Like, what do you think they do?
I think Bo will get in, and I think Tom will get in. I don't think Raleigh will get in. You said Lefty. I think Lefty is an inevitability, but I don't know. And then what was the fifth name, GP? Raleigh, Tom.
Eddie Sutton.
Eddie Sutton. Like, he's way due, in my opinion. Should be interesting. I don't know if they'll all get in. Izzo, I think, gets in. Like, he only has one title, but especially, like, here's the thing, like, especially if they really make a push and get another number one seed, and then, like, a really strong season is on the minds of the voters, and they, and Michigan State has the National Player of the Year, Valentine comes back really strong, I think I would expect him to get in this season.
I would I would think Bo gets in, and Izzo's definite, as far as I don't know how you could vote otherwise. I would think Bo gets in, although clearly he didn't get in last year. Mm-hmm. Those two, and I, you know, the other ones we could talk about forever, but whatever. The interesting news out of that in terms of first-time nominee Tom Izzo, Michigan State, first-time nominee for the Naismith Hall of Fame. If you're wondering right now, I think we have 7 active Hall of Fame coaches. Is that correct? 7?
Yes.
It's Krzyzewski. It's Mike Krzyzewski. It's Roy Williams. It's Rick Boeheim. Pitino, Jim Boeheim, Larry Brown.
Yes.
John Calipari. And who am I missing?
Oh, that's it.
It's 6.
Yeah, because Bo isn't in. I was thinking it's a 6 because Bo is not in, and I always keep thinking that he is, but he's not.
It's right. All right. So with Kentucky, here's the interesting thing: is that the talent's there, undeniably. Like if you held a draft tonight, Scal would, even though he's been a disappointment. Let's just speak openly. He'd still be taken in the top 5 or 10 of the draft, like tonight, right?
Yes.
I talked to an NBA person. Somebody connected to the NBA Saturday in Brooklyn. And they seemed mostly unconcerned about Scal. Like they said, you can still see all the stuff that you want to see on the offensive end. And his biggest issue, maybe not his biggest issue, but among his issues is that he's really skinny. And this person actually said to me, you know the great thing about skinny kids? And I said, what? And he said, they always add weight. They don't stay skinny. Like, you know, he'll be – like, that is not a concern for NBA people. And so he's still what – he hasn't played well consistently or often. But in terms of the talent, it's still there. Murray, we saw what he can do when he gets going. Briscoe, like, they've got still possibly the most talented roster in the country, certainly one of the most talented rosters in the country. The only thing that's interesting to me about it is that, or the one reason if I were a Kentucky fan, I might be concerned, and Sam, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on this, is that you look at DeAndre Jordan, Andre Drummond, Drew Holiday, Steven Adams. The one thing these guys all have in common, they're relevant NBA players, if not great NBA players, who did one and done, but they weren't very good in their 1 year of college. Like, it just didn't happen for them. You know, DeAndre came off A&M's bench. Drummond was a mess. Steven Adams was just a guy. Drew Holiday, I believe, averaged single digits in points. My point being, sometimes I guess this wouldn't surprise me. You could look up in 5 years and Scal's an all-star. And Briscoe's a rotation player for a good team, and Murray's an all-star level guy, whatever you think they are. And you look back, you go, wow, why wasn't Kentucky great with those 3 guys on the roster? And it'll just be because it took them longer to progress. Like, Kentucky could help develop these kids into guys who become great pros someday, but actually never reap the benefits from it because they'll be gone before they get good. Does that make sense? You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. As far as their NBA draft stocks, I mean, Scal's definitely fallen. I mean, he was a guy that I had at number 1 coming into the year.
Sure.
I think I'm going to move him down. I think I'm doing my, you know, progressions, my rankings right now, basically, not on the podcast.
How far would you take? How far would you take him down? Like, how far?
I knocked him down to 6, I believe.
Well, that's my point. Like, there's only so far, like, you can drop him.
Right. No, I'm not concerned about the body at all. The thing that concerns me is more the feel. He doesn't really go toward the ball. He doesn't attack the ball in the glass. His defensive instincts aren't really there yet. And you have to remember that he's 20 years old. Like, this is not a typical freshman. Like, he is a year and a half older than Brandon Ingram, for instance. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that gives him a little bit less time to develop. The body will be fine. I'm not real concerned about that. He'll put on weight. Even if it's only up to like 230, that should be enough to where he's fine. Though the feel is the thing that I think concerns NBA scouts at this point the most. And Jamal Murray, I'm not worried about at all. I actually have him at 5. I mean, you watch that Kentucky game against Ohio State. Yeah, he was dominant in the second half, but you even watch him in the first half, he should have had 40. Kentucky can't get out of his way, kind of. Like, he's so shifty and their spacing of the floor in the half court is so bad that he doesn't really have any lane or crease to attack. So I think if he was in kind of a different situation where their floor spacing was a little bit better, or if, maybe he played for Oregon or something like that, you'd be talking about a guy that's a surefire top 5 pick.
Sure. Do we think they're going to break through? Norlander, you saw him up close. Can you envision a scenario where we're in February and you go, I can't believe we spent that podcast December 21st wondering if Kentucky was going to break through? Now I look at them, they're the best team in the country.
That can happen. I have hesitations. I wrote about it afterward simply because Scal is not, listen, it's college is a lot different than AAU. Scal is not the guy that we saw on the AAU trail with what he's being asked to do, what he can and what he can't do. Has no post game whatsoever. It's stark to me. He would absolutely, if we had a draft, be picked in the top 10 right now. But I will also say right now, he is projecting to where, for the development of his game to be better, he should play a second year in college. It's probably not going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen.
Kentucky would be so – I mean, if they got Scal back next
year
–
he'd be crazy to go back to school. How do you go back to school unless you just want to go back to school?
Here's the thing with, like, Scal going back to school, and I've talked to Matt about this before. Like, Kentucky's not really using him in a way that's conducive to his development right now. Right. Like, yeah, he's developing a little bit more inside. He's – probably getting a little bit stronger with his body. I mean, that's probably the biggest place where you're talking about, Matt. But, you know, you look at his game, like he's a guy that NBA scouts and even at Hoop Summit, this is how he was used when I scouted him. Like, he's a guy that's used in pick and pops, pick and rolls. Sure. And that's where he's most effective on offense. And he's getting very little chance to do that right now.
He's a pick and pop four, stretch four. That's what he is.
Yeah. He's not being used that way. There's definitely something to that. I agree. But he's also, he's,
go
in a lot of ways.
Get that money, son. Go get the money.
Yeah. Well,
this
we'll
kid,
see.
This kid was lying under a rubble.
I get that too.
Haiti.
I know. I get
go get that money. And you know,
even if he falls to the end of the first round, go get that money.
Go get the. And here's the other thing. And I can never stress this enough. College basketball fans, not all but some, they reject this, but it's it drives me insane. You can develop in the NBA too. Like the, oh, you need to stay in school.
Oh,
and develop.
You definitely can.
Steven Adams, DeAndre Jordan, Andre Drummond, Drew Holiday. Like,
the, it's all circumstantial. Depends on the guy. Depends on the team. Depends on where you develop. Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. Sometimes it's the best of both worlds. Whereas like Kawhi Leonard needed all that time to develop at San Diego State, and by the way, then he went into the best possible situation ever, and now he's a top 15 NBA player.
He could. So, he could stay at Kentucky and develop like Alex Poitras.
There's the absolutely that can definitely be the case, although. Yeah, I mean, Poitras has kind of been overrated from the get-go. But regardless, Kentucky, in my opinion, is still the best team in the SEC. It's also lucky that the SEC isn't as good as we thought it should have been. It hasn't proven to be that. It can be a top-five team. I can foresee a situation where that happens. I've loved Jamal Murray from the start. I still love him. He was superb. Ulis needs to be better. His role has changed from what they wanted him to do last year and what he did do last year. In my opinion, Ulis was not, he didn't have as many jumpers contested. It was a different team last year, and what he did with that group is different from the way it is this year. I'm still waiting for Ulis to show himself to be a top five college point guard, which he has not shown himself to be, but which I think he can be. So Kentucky's really interesting. They're just not. They're not an elite team right now, and Cal knows that. And he's always, you know, I kind of led my column with, he's always been critical of his teams no matter what as a way of, you know, maybe humbling them against the way the media and fans can prop up their teams. And sometimes maybe that was necessary to keep them motivated. But I really felt that he was being pretty honest, maybe even to his chagrin, and just admitting that this is not a year ago. This team is not even close to being anywhere, anything of a dominant group. And can they get there? I mean, they can for sure. They've got the talent to do it, but they're just a ways away from it right now. And specifically, consistently having 6, 7, 8 game stretches where we watch Kentucky and they win by double digits and say, okay, yeah, yes, that's a top 3 team. They're just nowhere near that yet.
Matt Norlander, you tweeted this morning. Gary Parrish ranks UCLA over Monmouth despite Monmouth's win over UCLA. Monmouth has fewer losses, UCLA's worst strength of schedule, and UCLA only has 2 road neutral W's to Monmouth's 7. And then you put a frowny face emoji.
Well, you went Steve Harvey. You meant to say Monmouth, and you said UCLA. So it was a bummer.
Explain yourself. And let me make something very clear before we get into this.
Now, you explain yourself. You did the ranking.
Okay, easy. This is easy to do. First off, let me be very clear. I don't think there's anything wrong with ranking Monmouth. You want to rank Monmouth, you can. Doesn't matter to me. Like, you can reasonably do it. I got to write the poll text this afternoon, and if you want to rank Monmouth, if people rank Monmouth, I won't. That's not what I will identify and tear apart. But the idea that you have to rank Monmouth, that's just silly.
There's no have to. It's
the idea that they're clearly better than UCLA is an first off, let me just start with your points. Has fewer L's than UCLA. What does that even mean? Why does that matter?
It clearly does, because people rank teams based on number of losses more than quality of wins in general, when you look at the pattern of the way that voters rank in the AP poll, that is undeniable. Look at the loss column. And if teams only have 0-1-2 losses, they will always rank them ahead of teams with maybe 2-3 losses just because of the loss column and not necessarily look at the wins. I'm not saying that you do that. I'm saying that is an undeniable voter group think pattern.
That is, without a doubt. It also why the poll attacks exist, because it's stupid. It's a dumb thing. Right now, Arkansas Little Rock has fewer losses than Kansas.
Right.
What does it mean?
Kansas undeniably has a better record than Arkansas Little Rock. There's no doubt about it.
Fewer
but Arkansas Little Rock is another team that, in theory, should be considered for top 25 because it's not like they have terrible their schedules. Like Arkansas Little Rock right now should be ranked ahead of South Carolina if you're considering both teams, and both of those are undefeated teams.
My point is this. You're too smart to reference fewer L's as a arguing point for Monmouth over UCLA.
Well, you know.
I hold you to a higher standard, Norlander.
Okay, well, here's the thing. I think it's a relevant talking point specifically when those teams have played head-to-head and Monmouth has defeated UCLA.
The head-to-head is that's a great place to start.
And not only is it head-to-head, but it's head-to-head on UCLA's floor.
That's a great place to start. I'm just saying when you say they have fewer L's, that doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
That's a meaningless thing. Okay. So you reference Monmouth's 7 wins on road or neutral courts.
Which is the most in the country.
But that's also a meaningless – it's not a meaningless stat. Like it's not
meaningless. Specifically when you look at a team.
Okay, let me ask you this. Okay. How many good teams, not even great, just good, even play 7 road or neutral games by December 21st?
That's irrelevant. The fact that
– No, it's not irrelevant.
It is because the fact is that Monmouth has gone on and played those and they've won 7 freaking times.
But to say that that's somehow no,
you can't hold it against them that other big teams refuse to do that. You cannot hold that against Monmouth. That's unfair.
I'm not holding against Monmouth. I'm just trying to.
You are by not ranking them, GP.
No, I'm trying to explain to you that stating that nobody else in the country has done that is meaningless because almost no other good team in the country would even have an opportunity to do that. UCLA,
they have the opportunity, they choose not to.
No, you're smarter than that. That's a dumb thing to say.
It's okay to just say
even if
I'm
Duke
not going to rank Monmouth because it's not a traditional thing that people are doing. And I totally get.
No, don't be. No, let's talk about actually thing. Don't be dismissive. Let's talk about it actually. If North Carolina wanted to play 7 road or neutral games by December 21st, they could not do that. They can't do it. They have to have so many home games in the Dean Smith.
Kind of flashing back to what we talked about last week. Yes, there is legitimacy to that point. Without a doubt, you got to schedule the home games because you got ticket packages and you got to do that.
Right.
I understand the system is built that way.
Right. That's my point. And like UCLA at this point, since we're talking UCLA and Monmouth, UCLA has only played 5 road or neutral games. So let me be clear. Monmouth winning 7 of those is awesome, like independent of everything else. But that they're the only team – this is my point. They're the only team in the country to do that. More so because they're like the only quality team in the country that even has an opportunity to do that based off schedules.
Can I just toss one team out at you real quick here?
Sure, sure.
Okay, so let's look at Baylor, right? Baylor has only played 2 games away from home. It has lost both of those games, and I will grant you that both of the teams that it played will likely be tournament teams in Oregon and Texas A&M.
Right.
But then you look at Baylor, the rest of Baylor's schedule. It has 1 win against a team ranked 100 or 20th or better in KenPom.
Right.
And you measure that against Monmouth, who only has 1 more loss, okay? And I know the loss to Canisius is bad, but it came on the road. But a 3-point loss to Dayton, and Monmouth wins. I mean, the resume is not even freaking close, man. So it's not just the UCLA thing.
No,
my general point is this. I feel like, and I'm not accusing you, I feel like there's just this groupthink aspect when people rank in the polls. And because Monmouth has that 1 loss to Canisius, it so outweighs the fact of all they've done away from home. This team's only played 1 home game to this point. And if you looked at the resumes right now and we created a 68-team field and you just – let's just call Monmouth the automatic bid winner out of the MAC.
Mm-hmm.
There is no scenario where they're anything worse than a 4 seed. So my point is if you're not worse than a 4 seed, that's a top 16 resume. You should be included in the top 25 poll. That's all. It's just let's not be afraid, especially in December, because we know Monmouth is going to lose games in the MAC. Let's just not be afraid to put them 24th or 25th when there are resumes.
Nobody's afraid. What do you talk? You talk about ranking Monmouth
honestly,
like it's ISIS.
GP, I honestly think people are afraid because of what you do every Monday. I honestly think that has a genuine impact on the way some people cast their ballots, which I'm glad that it does, I guess.
I do. Listen, it is an impact on some people. I even have coaches. There are coaches who will text message me who have to do their coaches ballot and say, hey, can you send me over your top 25 and 1? I swear to God, I've had head coaches text message me, just say, hey, listen, I don't have time to deal with this. Just send me. I'm just going to copy yours, right?
Oh, my God.
No, that is a fact, a head coach. So, but not everybody cares. And either way, I don't think people are scared. I think people kind of like the idea of Monmouth. Why wouldn't you want to rank Monmouth? It's they've accomplished stuff on the court. The bench is great. King Rice looks like he could be a coaching star. Like, I love the Monmouth story. And again, I don't think there's anything dumb with ranking Monmouth. For me, specifically, like you, this is where you can get into my thought behind how I do what I do, and we can actually disagree reasonably. Like sometimes people disagree nonsensically, but this is something you could reasonably disagree with. I won't even insist that I'm right. I see the flaw in this. You bring up Baylor. Here's the way I get Baylor still ranked at 8-2 with no good wins. Except, well, they got a Vanderbilt win. That's a good win. I have a hard time, once you're in the rankings, I don't like dropping you out until you lose something you're not supposed to lose. You know, that's sort of where I'm at. Like, so with Baylor, you know, I had them in to start the year. I certainly had them in after they lost, I mean, after they beat Vanderbilt. And since then, the only loss, and it's a lopsided loss, but it's a loss at Texas A&M, another team I have ranked ahead of them. So by my standard, they haven't done anything except to lose games they were supposed to lose. And since they were already in there, I'll just keep them there. Now, some people might just say, well, that's stupid. You rank resumes. Go look at Monmouth. Go look at Baylor. Monmouth is better than Baylor. I don't disagree with that. I'm just saying, from my perspective, once I got you in there, like I've got Baylor in there, you're going to have to do something to remove yourself. And Baylor has, the only thing it's done is lose a true road game at a Texas A&M team I have ranked ahead of them.
So here's my question. We don't have to harp on this for 15 minutes. And Sam is just chilling over there. But so I just
tossed Malik Beasley into the top 50 of my draft rankings.
There you go. At least you're getting productive work done.
I don't expect this to happen, but let's be honest, there is a possibility that it could because Gonzaga has not looked good. Gonzaga opens its West Coast Conference play on Monday night, which is kind of crazy. It's December 21st and the WCC is already starting league play. But if Gonzaga were to lose to Pepperdine on Monday night, would you bump them out? And is Monmouth basically 27 right now?
I really never look past what I'm doing. If Gonzaga loses to Pepperdine, of course they're gone. And then what I'll do is I'll look at all the other candidates. I'll look at South Carolina. I'll look at Monmouth. I'll look at, how about this? Do you want me to make you a promise, Norlander?
You don't have to promise me anything. My whole crusade here is that I feel as though small league schools, mostly rightfully most of the time, there is a prejudice against them because of the schedule that they play. And so people are way, way, way too hesitant to legitimately include them into the poll when we get to this time of year. And I'd say in 9 out of 10 cases, maybe that's justified. But every couple of years, there's a team that really deserves some sort of consideration. They usually don't get it. And Monmouth is just unprecedented. Someone tweeted out, it might have been Dan Walken, who you put on your radio show. Like, I don't know. And I don't have the time to research this. I don't even know if ESPN has the time to research this. I don't know if there's ever been a team from a one-bid league that has beaten 5 major conference teams in college basketball before Christmas. Like, I don't even think this has ever happened before. So the whole historical precedent of what Monmouth has done and the way that it's done it, and if you've watched them play, that's all. It's rightfully gotten a lot of love for its bench, and those dudes are freaking awesome. Like, the Star Wars thing was great. I want to see how they incorporate the Steve Harvey thing into their next sideline bench thing. Like, I want them to do it. I think they're fantastic. But from a basketball perspective, they do deserve a lot of credit, and that's basically where I'm coming
from. I'm fine with that. Clearly, if Gonzaga loses, they're out, and then I'll look at the other candidates, and Monmouth is clearly one of them. Again, let me repeat myself, and then we'll move on. If somebody thinks Mama should be ranked, I got that. That is not something I'll call dumb. There's nothing dumb about it. They have they've been good on the court, and I don't know that it's a top 25 resume, but I do know it's something that you could reasonably interpret as a top 25 resume. So rank them if you want to, smoke them if you got them. Butler beat Purdue. They are probably one of the more pleasant surprises in college basketball this season, just because. I think we knew they could be good, like top 25 good. I don't think anybody thought they would be a team that's sitting here with a 9-1 record victories over Purdue, true road win at Cincinnati, only loss to a Miami team that's also ranked, and a top 10 offense in the country. I wrote about this, I think, a week ago in the Inside College Hoops column. Last year, Butler was really good defensively, like number 7 defensive efficiency and 82nd in offense. This year, they're 6th in offense, 96th in defense. You don't really see teams flip that like that from a year to year, do you?
Not normally. I mean, Sam wrote about this. I mean, Sam, do you want to take it first? I've been kind of rambling here.
Sure. Yeah, so Butler's been really good on offense this year, like GP said.
How's that happen? How do you go, from a basketball perspective, Sam, how do you go from being terrible at on offense last year but great defensively to great on offense this year and just okay defensively inside of a year with a very similar roster?
Well, the roster did change in a pretty meaningful way. I mean, they lost Cameron Woods, sure, who was a really big piece of what they wanted to do inside. He was a great rebounder. And without him involved, they play a pretty undersized lineup. Like, yeah, I know that Tyler Wideman is, in theory, as big as Cam Woods, but I don't think he brings the same interior presence in a lot of ways. He brings kind of a different skill set as well because he's kind of a bigger body. And at the beginning of the year, Chris Holtmann kind of said that he wanted to run instead. They have all these great guards. They have Tyler Lewis coming in to man the point. They have Kellen Dunham. They have Roosevelt Jones, who can do a lot of crafty little goofy things in the half court. So why not get out and run? Why not do a total shift in philosophy? Plus, you have to remember Chris Holtmann came in at kind of a strange time last year, sure, where he might not have been able to implement what he wanted to do last year. So it's a really interesting situation. You guys are totally right. The question that I have about them is, like you guys alluded to, it's the defense. The defense really ratcheted it up against Purdue. They were awesome. And that's the first time this year they've really been awesome like that. Like, even against Cincinnati, I thought they kind of struggled. Even against teams like Miami, Temple even, they were not that great. But against Purdue, they looked great. They denied all of the entry passes to Hammonds, to Haas, to Swanigan. They forced Swanigan away from the basket. Rayfield Davis struggled basically with Kellen Dunham. It was a really impressive performance. If they can come along on that end of the floor, I think this is a top 10 team, but you know, I'm not going to say that it's a done deal after one game necessarily.
And by the way, I've got 4 Big East teams in the top 15 of the top 25 and one with Villanova being 4th out of those 4. So that's not something I don't think many people anticipated heading into this season. Providence has been better than expected. They've got that win over Arizona and a lone loss to Michigan State. That's Michigan State with Denzel Valentine. Xavier has been awesome. And Butler, better than anybody anticipated. While Villanova, I think, still good, but they do have 2 losses to the 2 best teams they played. Let's look ahead a little bit before we get out of here. Norlander, I know it's the week of Christmas, so it's not a great week, but tomorrow night, Tuesday night, does present an interesting group of games, right?
Yeah, it does. So I did a post back in the preseason that was the 30 best college basketball games non-conference before Christmas came, and actually tomorrow had 4 of those games listed: Cal, Virginia, Vandy, Purdue, Kansas, San Diego State, and Iowa State. Cincy. I'll just a quick thought on each of these, and I'll let you guys go. Cal, I don't see how it wins. It kind of needs the win just to establish credibility again. This team was my pick to win the Pac-12. It hasn't been awful. It's 9-2. It had a bad back-to-back stretch. Since then, hasn't really played anyone legitimate outside of St. Mary's and got a nice 4-point home win 2 weeks back. But if it can play Virginia and keep us keep our attentions basically for the entire 2 hours and play them close, that will be good for them. Expecting them to go in and asking them to win at UVA, the number one team in KenPom right now, it's way too much. Virginia looks terrific. It played out of its freaking mind against Villanova over the weekend, and the Hoos, we'll get to them on another podcast. Vandy at Purdue to me is super interesting because you got a battle of the skylines there, really the tallest legitimate matchup between top 25 teams we've seen so far in college hoops this season. Purdue, let's just see how they react to getting, you know, beat by Butler and legitimately beat by Butler. I mean, Purdue could have had that game, wasn't able to hold on, and now it has to turn around and play its final non-conference game against a Vanderbilt team that has been good but up and down. To me, this is a real litmus test for Vandy and the SEC, because when you look at Vandy and you've seen them, they've looked good in spots, but the best teams they've played against, they've all lost. The other teams that they've played that they should beat, they've beaten easily. So let's just see what Kevin Stallings' team can do against the latest legitimate team it plays against. If Vandy gets smacked tomorrow by Purdue, and it is, you know, that is a possibility. This is a road game. Expecting Vandy to win, we shouldn't, but let's see if they can keep it close. If they don't, then we might have to call out Vandy for being a little too fraudulent. KU at San Diego State. San Diego State has been an utter disaster. I don't understand what has happened to that program. It's 7-5. It's never great on offense, but it is unusually abysmal, and it is 5-5 against D1 teams. So Kansas should win that, but let's remember San Diego State has played Kansas well in recent memory. I'm intrigued by it. It's not a great game, but San Diego State needs that to basically salvage its season at this point. And then Iowa State-Cincinnati is actually the game I'm most interested in on Tuesday, because Cincinnati, typically, you know, Cincy gets overlooked just because it's never a flashy or sexy team, but it has been pretty good so far. Lost to Butler, lost a game against Xavier where Xavier handled them, but Xavier looks great so far. Cincy could really use it. Iowa State got beat by UNI, and I don't know. I have never really fully bought into Iowa State to this point. I don't know what to expect from this game. To me, it's the biggest toss-up, so it's the one I'm most intrigued about. But point is, College Hoops fans definitely should be paying attention tomorrow night, because it is a very, very interesting slate in the last, like, really, you know, compact slate with a lot of really good games for more than a week.
Sam, you got one you're looking forward to?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Purdue and Vanderbilt for sure. Luke Kornet's out with that knee injury still. So the size lineup there is going to be a little bit different than what Vanderbilt's shown throughout the beginning part of their season, at least. They've been going a little bit smaller. And the thing is that I think that Butler kind of gave them a little bit of a blueprint as far as how to beat Purdue. You try and deny all entry passes. And with guys like Wade Baldwin and Riley LaChance and Matt Fisher Davis, they can kind of do that. They have pretty decent length and pretty decent perimeter defenders to hold that down. The key is just going to be if Damian Jones shows up. He's been a guy that really hasn't grown, I would say, this year. He's still kind of the same guy, I would say, that he was over his freshman and sophomore years. And that's not the worst thing in the world. I mean, he's a probable first round pick, even if he doesn't show growth. But Wade Baldwin's kind of taken that team over as the guy. And I'm really interested to see how Purdue comes back from that loss. I think that could be a really fun storyline. And like Matt said, Iowa State, Cincinnati is really interesting, because Cincinnati is going to just pressure the heck out of Iowa State in a way that they probably haven't gotten a chance to see yet, even this year, even though they lost to UNI. So that's a fascinating game to me. I kind of think Cincinnati wins.
Keep an eye on Xavier at Wake Forest. You know, I think Xavier's awesome, but Wake has won 5 straight. They own wins.
Good call.
They own wins over Indiana and UCLA, and it's a true road game. Like, true road games are tough. Like, you know, listen, yeah. San Diego State stinks. Kansas is great, but like, you go into that building like it ain't easy, you know, and Wake Forest isn't bad. Like Danny Manning's done a good job there, and they're 8-2 right now. And they're at home, and they've already proven good enough to beat an Indiana team on a neutral and a UCLA team on a neutral. And, you know, Indiana isn't bad, not as bad as they've looked at times. And UCLA, well, you know, we've seen them beat Gonzaga and Kentucky. So that Xavier at Wake Forest game, as much as I...
which is, by the way, the Skip Prosser Classic, sure. And it's just awesome that they even play that, yeah. Because Skip, yeah. The late Skip, you know, coached at both
obviously
places.
Coached at both schools. So just keep an eye on that one. I don't know that I'm predicting a Wake Forest upset, but there's nothing unique about watching a top 10 team lose a true road game to a quality opponent. And I think this qualifies as that, a top 10 team in a true road game against a quality opponent. All right, well, let's get out of here. Well, I think we've all got stuff to do. Maybe try to do one more of these before.
Well, how do you want to do this, GP? Because it's a weird week, right?
It is a weird week. It's like Santa Claus comes. When does Santa Claus come? Thursday night?
He comes on Friday.
Is it Friday?
He comes Thursday night into Friday.
Yeah.
And so we know, like, Friday's Christmas.
Yeah, I ain't trying to talk to you on Friday.
I know you're not. And like Christmas, I mean, maybe Wednesday.
Wednesday. Wednesday feels right.
You know, then you got Christmas. People travel on Christmas Eve. They got to listen to the podcast.
Of course. So, hey, let's meet back here on Wednesday. And hopefully, as we're getting ready to do it, a National Player of the Year candidate doesn't have knee surgery and a future Hall of Fame coach doesn't get nominated for the Hall of Fame for the first time, because that can sort of mess things up. So we will talk again on Wednesday. Till then, take care.